Thursday, March 21st, I slept until 9 o'clock, or rather I woke at 9 o'clock, after a long night in bed during which I alternately slept, and lay and listened to the wind as it beat and battered in its wild assault on the house. The two long walls of the room were glass, so I had the curious feeling that I was on a mountaintop right under the sky, protected and yet utterly embraced by the storm. Black clouds were scudding across the sky, and fitfully the moon shone from behind them. The tree outside the window was bending from the wind, and the surf shrieked on the rocks. It was an eerie, lonely feeling for this beautiful, placid place I had known. But awake at 9, the world was golden bright. I went downstairs and had coffee, and fruit and cereal, and quickly dressed, for Noble was here, and we were going on a hike into the mountains. We had reached Trudy and Joe Califano, who are at St. Thomas's. They'd caught the first boat over and arrived just as I was getting ready to leave. Trudy, gloriously brown, her blonde hair swinging, was all eagerness to go on the hike. So Trudy and Noble and I set out. Right after breakfast, I never look at a clock from morning until night. We rode a jeep to Cruz Bay, St. John's only town, and then climbed upward in a winding corniche drive that clung to the mountainside, keeping always on the left, and my heart would be in my throat as we would round a corner and there would come charging at us another jeep, and around each corner a more beautiful view of another blue bay with white sails and a little sandy horseshoe of a beach with green mountains rising right behind. We passed trees with peeling red bark, and I thought of Madrona trees. Noble said they were called the Naked Indian, and a little switch would be stuck in the ground and they would grow into fence posts, and so we did see them, often along the roadside. Finally, we seemed to be winding along the very crest of the mountain, and we stopped at a sign that said, Old Ruin. It pointed down the mountainside to a sugar mill, to petroglyphs, and farthest to the beach at Reef Bay, 2 5/10 miles. Noble said it was an old carriage road for oxen. On the downhill side, it was shored up with stones, but the growth had encroached on the uphill side, and there had been no repairs for how many years, and so it had grown narrower and narrower. The vegetation was dense, exotic, a myriad varieties of trees and plants. The huge kapok tree with its tortured trunk, that at its base has wide flanges reaching out like the knees of a seated man. The West Indian locust with its fat black pods. A strange parasite called a clutia that looks like a sea grape that grows out of a crotch of a tree and then sends its roots straight down through the air to the ground. They grow bigger and bigger, some wind around the parent tree, and finally it is dead. Fragrant lime with that tiny fruit. And one of the prettiest of all called Jenep. Tall, slim, with a smooth bark that is gray and white and brown splotched. It looks just like the camouflage of our soldiers in the jungle. Big bay trees with that deliciously aromatic leaves. And mangoes, some heavily fruited. A vicious-looking shrub called a pingwing, a wild pineapple. It grows about 4 feet high, a mass of long blades that arc gracefully up and then bend to the ground, each one equipped with hundreds of little saw teeth that would just cut you to pieces, it looks like, if you stumbled into the plant. Noble told us that the old-time overseers planted them below their bedroom windows. They needed to keep them open at night for the breeze, and they were always afraid that the slaves might slip in and cut their throats. But not through these shrubs. Some of them had brilliant red centers, and that meant that they were fruiting with a small yellow pineapple-like fruit. I have no idea how anybody ever got to them. There was very little wildlife in this green jungle. An occasional zebra butterfly, or hermit crab scuttling to safety in a rock. Very rarely a bird high above, but there was one strange form of life. Enormous termite nests, way up in the trees, big as bushel baskets. They appeared to be made of mud. Noble told me it was the waste from their own bodies, and they traveled in little tunnels from the ground up the tree to their nests, which were like a honeycomb on the inside. But the strangest of all things was the hand of man in this jungle. Almost straight up the road wound. It was perilous walking, and yet it had been used for sugarcane fields, Noble told me. White man first came to St. John's Island in 1718, when the Danes explored it. Although Christopher Columbus had actually stopped at St. Croix, 325 years before, in 1493, though only to take on water. The fierce Carib Indians there drove them away, the story goes. The Danes had expanded from St. Thomas's to St. John's, bringing their sugarcane and the mills with them, and slave labor to terrace the mountainsides, building stone walls to make terraces against erosion up the mountainsides, stripping off the jungle and planting sugarcane. Through the trees we could actually see some of these terraces still. And just as strange, we began to encounter stone walls, often 3 or 4 feet thick and shoulder high, outlining a corral or a house site or a pasture. Finally, we came to one that followed us for more than a mile down the mountainside along the oxen road. It was incredible, the amount of labor that went into building those walls and clearing that land and planting that sugarcane. But the jungle is avenged, and now it is just as though man had never been here. Mm-hmm. And then we came to the first sugar mill, a mile and a half or so up the mountainside from the ocean. Trees have sprouted inside its rooms and grown to 20 or even 30 feet tall. It is covered with vine, but part of the walls stand, the front door outlined clearly, on one side about 30 feet of masonry. And this was the most fascinating tale of all, because it was made partly of sawed brain coral that must have grown for, was it thousands of years, under the sea, partly of thin, pinkish-red Danish bricks that came as ballast in the hold of a ship that had gone back carrying rum and molasses, and partly from the black volcanic rock of which this island is made, all put together with cement by the hand of man, how long ago Noble did not know, nor how long ago abandoned. He knew that after the slaves were freed, in 1830-odd it was, it became economically unfeasible to run these sugarcane plantations, and the fields gradually retreated down the mountainside. The forests up high were cut for charcoal, and then pretty much abandoned. But still, down close to the sea, the last mills operated, now driven by steam, to serve the dwindling cane fields. Although the Danes owned them and reaped the principal financial harvest, the overseers, he said, the people that actually lived here and came in contact with the slaves, were English or Irish, hence the English language, and much, much later, the habit of driving on the left side of the road. We, of course, had acquired the Virgin Islands from the Danes in 1917, one of the results of the World War. It was farther down the mountain that we came to another sign of the hand of man. A National Park Service sign pointed off to the right, 0.2 miles to the petroglyphs. We left the oxen road and followed a much narrower trail that wound upward until we came to a waterfall, or rather an enormous, magnificent path of a waterfall that was now dry except for a pool at the base and farther on down another pool. A wildly dramatic looking place. I wondered if they had used it in times past as a ceremonial place for worship or gathering. Anyhow, there were petroglyphs on the rocks, carved, Noble said, by the Arawaks, who had lived there in pre-Columbian days, making pottery, cultivating a few things, leading a quiet and peaceful life, until the cannibal Caribs moved in, killed most of the men, and took the women and children as slaves. It was the Caribs that Columbus had found on St. Croix, and what had become of them, who knows? The petroglyphs were quite clearly defined, and one has been used as the well-known insignia of Caneo Bay Plantation. On boats and dinner napkins and stationery, there were perhaps 6 or 8 different kinds, one in the shape of a grinning skull, one that had an almost pixie quality, like a character from Peanuts. Noble scooped water with his hands from the pool and threw it over them to make them stand out in clearer relief. But it was not these rather pitiful men that interested me most. It was the Danes and the black slaves that had labored in the cane fields, and the English and Irish overseers, and their futile attempt to turn this steep mountainside into a farm. Such arrogance. We were beginning to get tired. The trail was flattening out. We were approaching the sea. There were a few more familiar things. Bamboo, thick. Mother-in-law's tongue, South Siberia. And occasionally, my old friend Lantana. There's much about this place that reminds me of Bang San, Thailand, and the Bay of Siam, the blue sea and the wooded mountains, but it lacks the fecundity of that land. Just as we came within the sound of the sea, we saw the ruins of the last sugar factory. It had been in use when Noble's father was a child, and he'd told him tales of how you could go to one side of it and receive a taste of the rum in a dipper, and on the other side your little boy could go and get a stick of sugar cane to chew. It had been horse-driven in its earliest days, and we found the big flat circle where the horse had gone round and round. So had I seen it in my childhood in East Texas, and the little stone-lined sluiceway where the juice had poured downhill into the vat. Much of the walls were still sanding. Here the Park Service had restored a bit, and it did not have quite that utterly lost-in-the-jungle look of Angkor Wat, with 30 feet trees growing from the rooms. The gears were still in place, huge rusting machinery, and enormous round pots 4 or 5 feet in diameter. Amazingly enough, back up along the trail we had come across several signs of man. 3 of these huge pots were used for water for cattle, scrawny, bony cattle, and occasionally beside the roadway, the rusted rim of an ox cart wheel. Steam engines had been brought in to replace the motive power of the horse. I bent over and read the legend that appeared on the side of the great engine, now partly overgrown with vines. A&M Maconi, M-C-O-N-I-E, Glasgow, Scotland, 1861. And thus it had persisted through a dwindling economy until about 1924. It was almost on the beach, a beautiful sandy beach, and we saw a long, comfortable boat awaiting us with cold beer from the manager of Caneel Bay and Captain Smith, who had taken me out when I was here before. He was an old man, about 77. He remembered when this sugar mill was last in operation. He also told me, rather scornfully, rather regretfully, that things were different now, that there wasn't enough rain, that there used to be just lots of rain. It would rain for 2 days and nights, and that is how they had been able to raise sugar cane, he said. The water was gloriously blue, but the breeze still stiff. We went to Cruz Bay, past several anchored catamarans and glistening white sailboats, and in our jeeps and back to the house. Bess and Joe were in from snorkeling, or rather swimming, because the water had been too murky and the wind too high to snorkel happily. We ate enormously from the delicious buffet. And then I listened to the sad news that Linda Bird was having trouble getting in. Bad weather. Inevitably, my mind went to Stephen and Aldrich Courier, and I was thankful for the Secret Service, sure that they would make her stay in San Juan, although Jerry told me that was one of the 5 most dangerous places in the world, if the flight wasn't considered entirely safe. For all our ignoring of time, I saw someone's watch at the lunch table, and it was 3:30, so I know it must have been after 4 when I went to take a nap, but instead read Look Homeward, Angel by Thomas Wolfe, a fallout of our trip to Nashville. The book had been given to me by Thomas Wolfe's brother, Fred, in their old home. Jerry called me and said that Linda Bird had arrived safely in San Juan and was already in the air. The winds had quieted enough, headed for St. Thomas, and she arrived about sundown, weary and full of funny long stories about the 2 full days that it had taken her to get from the ranch to the Rockefeller's house here. I stopped at the entrance and showed her the view as you looked through the hall out toward the beach and the bay, and a ship in the distance and St. Thomas beyond, and a little later the extraordinarily brilliant evening star, which looks like it's just been pinned up for the occasion. She and Bess and I had a merry time before dinner with a drink and the long recital of her odyssey. And then we dined by candlelight. There was a power failure, with a good broiled steak and a birthday cake for Linda. Bess had thought of it. The sparklers on top. And I brought down her present, some old Dickens books, including Christmas Carol, which Mr. Fleming had found for me. And Bess gave her a mask and a snorkel tube. My daddy had sent her a traveling clock, a Georgia pearl bracelet, and a Secret Service earrings to match. I think she might carry the precinct she lives in, those who know her best. And Lucy and Pat a lounging outfit. And then we went to bed early, with the wind quietening a bit, and all of us hoping for 80-degree weather and a still sea tomorrow.